I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Think of it as a first draft, a test run of a Republican re-election platform for a president who's pretty sure he knows how he can win a second term in November.
We've not come all this way through tragedy and trial and war only to falter and leave our work unfinished. Americans are rising to the tasks of history, and they expect the same from us.
President George W. Bush has transformed the international image of America in the last 2 years, some say for the better, some say for the worse. But Bush has his answer for those crying unilateralist.
Britain, Australia, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Thailand, Italy, Spain, Poland, Denmark, Hungary, Bulgaria, Ukraine, Romania, the Netherlands.
And yet Bush is not relinquishing his notion of a great republic.
There is a difference, however, between leading a coalition of many nations and submitting to the objections of a few. America will never seek a permission slip to defend the security of our country.
This hour on The Connection, we want to know if you agree with the president that the State of the Union is, quote, confident and strong. Do you support the president's vision and agenda for the nation? Or are you ready for a change of course? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, in just a couple of moments, we'll hear from General Wesley Clark to hear how he thinks the speech plays in the Democratic race to challenge George Bush. But let's go first to the two who'll be with us for this hour. Alan Murray is Washington Bureau Chief for CNBC. He's joining us from the nation's capital. Alan, nice to have you back on the program.
Oh, it's great to be back. I love your show.
And Nolan Findlay's joining us. He is the editorial page editor of the Detroit News, joining us from the NPR affiliate WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Nolan, welcoming you back as well to The Connection. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Dick.
I wonder if between the three of us, we can just listen to one more moment from last night's speech, and then I want to get your reactions, because in many ways it sounded to me that this was Bush's call to the nation to stay the course with him.
We have faced serious challenges together, and now we face a choice. We can go forward with confidence and resolve, or we can turn back to the dangerous illusion that terrorists are not plotting and outlaw regimes are no threat to us. We can press on with economic growth and reforms in education and Medicare, or we can turn back to old policies and old divisions.
Alan Murray, the sort of call to an election. Did you hear that as well last night?
Oh, absolutely. But I think your phrase, stay the course, is the right one. There was no soaring rhetoric here. There was no grand new vision. There really weren't. There wasn't even much in the way of new proposals in this speech. What it was a defense of the course that the president has followed for the last 3 years and an indication that he intends to stay right on that course and wants the nation to go with him.
And do you think, Alan, that's exactly where he ought to be here, or are you saying that there was some of vision missing?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. You know, there was an interesting poll out yesterday, a Washington Post ABC News poll, and it said that the American public is pretty much with him on foreign policy. They think going into Iraq was the right thing to do in spite of the fact that we haven't found stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. They think his war against terror is basically the right thing to do. They're okay with him on his education. Leave No Child Behind Act. But there are some questions about other domestic policies. People aren't that happy about the Medicare prescription drug bill. They don't feel that the Republicans or the president does a better job than the Democrats on a number of domestic policy issues. And they do indicate that they care more about those things than they do about foreign policy. So, you know, the president gets high marks for his consistency. But does consistency guarantee him re-election? I don't think we're there yet by any means.
What do you think, Nolan?
Well, I think what you saw last night was a reintroduction to George W. Bush. For the last several months, the Democrats have had almost a nonstop platform to paint a very unflattering picture of this president and his policies and performance. And last night was his opportunity to set the record straight. He seemed to relish it, and he seemed to be very pumped and primed for the campaign to come.
Do you agree, though, that the idea of just saying, here's who I am, is exactly where he wants to be?
Well, he has presided over a very eventful presidency, and I think it's perfectly appropriate for him to run on his record rather than to make grand sweeping new promises. He has a very, very strong record to put before the American people, or at least one that that contains a lot of different facets for him to make a case for re-election.
Now, of course, the other place where this speech was getting very close attention was in New Hampshire, where candidates for the Democratic nomination are in such a heated battle of their own. Just a few moments ago, I spoke with General Wesley Clark. He's in Dover, New Hampshire. And I asked him if he and his people were watching the speech last night.
We sure did. We had 900 people in the theater here in Manchester watching the speech together.
And what did you think of it?
Well, you know, I thought that it was pretty much what we expected. He's going to try to run on a war record of taking us to a war we didn't have to fight. And he's going to continue to press for billions and billions of dollars of tax cuts for the people who need it least and ignore those who have the greatest needs in America.
General Clark, I want to get your take on one key part of the president's message last night. Perhaps we can just listen together to one clip.
As part of the offensive against terror, we are also confronting the regimes that harbor and support terrorists and could supply them with nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. The United States and our allies are determined. We refuse to live in the shadow of this ultimate danger.
All right, you're hearing him cast the policy of this country in the years ahead. What do you make of the idea of confronting all these regimes, refusing to live in the shadow of danger?
Well, I think we've got a president who's a cheerleader, and he is trying to rally the nation for a continuing series of crises and struggles that he can use to retain power in America. It's what my friend Ted Sorensen has said. He said that Bush's foreign policy is his domestic policy. It's a policy of the war on terror, fear and concern across America, and perpetual Republican majorities. And last night you may notice that he called to renew the Patriot Act. And this is the part and parcel of his policy. He wants to use the threats abroad to retain power at home.
These crises and struggles that you refer to, are you saying that he's manufacturing them or perpetuating them for his own political ends?
Well, what I'm saying is that wise U.S. leadership will always have challenges and difficulties in the world. But if we work with our allies, if we build common interests, we can meet our larger purposes of improving America's security, keeping America safe, and advancing our prosperity. We don't have to make the crisis and conflict the central issue of our lives. And if we do, we risk these becoming simply political showpieces. We went into a war in Iraq that we didn't have to fight. It was an elective war. We went into it on what I believe was a political deadline of the 30th of March last year to get the war going so it could be over, so he could concentrate for the election. Now what we've got is another, I think, politically inspired deadline of the 30th of June of this year to hand the problem back over to the Iraqis. It doesn't look to me like either the 30th of March or the 30th of June were the kinds of dates that you would take if you were seriously working for the best solution. They were just dates that are fundamental. They're in Washington political calculus, and that's the danger we face as a nation. We're dragged into things we don't have to be into. We're being led by an administration that goes about meeting America's challenges the wrong way.
So there you are in New Hampshire in a theater with 900 people watching President Bush deliver his State of the Union address. And I can't help but think that there was probably a part of that time last night when you were imagining what your own State of the Union address might be. What would the headline of a Wes Clark State of the Union address be, if you could give us that?
Well, we're going to value the American people. We're going to keep the country safe. We're going to bring jobs to America. We're going to put America back to work, provide employment, provide health services, strengthen our education program, and move effectively and constructively into the 21st century.
And you know, General, the other thing that I read between the lines or heard between the lines in the President's State of the Union speech last night was this sort of notion that, you know, we're on this course, I'm in charge, let's not switch leaders in midstream. And I was thinking of the time when about 5 years ago, when you were rather unceremoniously yanked from your job as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, in charge of the fighting there in Kosovo. And there were people at the time who said, you know, you shouldn't have pulled Wes Clark out then. He was the man in charge. You should have left him there. Can the president make the same case that these are troubled times? I need another term?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a logical case for him to make if you look at it from his perspective, but he's not carrying any unique authority or experience or judgment on these matters. He came into office unlearned, unschooled, and essentially disinterested in foreign affairs from all of his background, and now he's there. He didn't do everything he could have done to protect the country from 9/11. He's taken us into a war we don't have to fight. The actual aftermath of the war has been handled in a ham-handed manner, to say the least. If you look at the policy inconsistencies, the stops and goes and fits and starts of this administration's record in Iraq since the 1st of May, it shows a real absence of effective presidential and military diplomatic leadership. So I think it's time for the country to change leadership, and that's why I'm running for office.
Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Dick.
Retired General Wesley Clark in Dover, New Hampshire. Time for a quick comment from Alan Murray, host of CNBC's nightly program Capital Report. Alan, we hear Clark and his competitors attacking Bush on the war, on foreign policy, on domestic issues. Where's the real soft spot? Where's he vulnerable?
Well, I don't think it's going to be foreign policy. You know, a couple of interesting things came out of Iowa, and I think they're worth paying some attention to. Howard Dean was the strong anti-war candidate. He put in a very disappointing performance. Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean were the two candidates who wanted to repeal the entire Bush tax cut. They both had very disappointing performances. The hardcore anti-Bush critique that says he shouldn't have gone to war and he shouldn't have done any of these tax cuts doesn't sell even with a Democratic audience. Now, that's the good news for Bush. The bad news for Bush is that as a result of what happened to Iowa, he's probably not going to face a candidate who's pushing the hardcore anti-Bush critique. He's probably going to face a much more moderate candidate. Even if it's Howard Dean, I predict you'll see a much more moderate Howard Dean than you did in Iowa.
Connection listeners, do you agree with the president that the state of this union is both confident and strong? Do you agree with his vision and agenda for the nation? We'd like to hear from you on our program this hour. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we are listening to and talking about last night's State of the Union speech. And trying to get a sense from our guests and our callers whether or not the president has got his finger on the nation's pulse. 58% of the people seem to think that he's got it right. That's the highest approval rating for a president at this point in his presidency in almost 50 years. No one since Eisenhower has had those kind of numbers. So obviously they know something in the Oval Office. 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear what you have to think. Alan Murray's with us. He's Washington Bureau Chief for CNBC, and Nolan Finley is the editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tom's joining us on the line. Tom, what do you think?
Good morning. I've been a lifelong Democrat, so I tend to disagree with the president on a lot of the domestic things that he's talking about. You know, the defense of marriage, all the whole defense of marriage discussion sort of makes me roll my eyes. But on Iraq, I completely agree with what he's done, with what's gone on. I just think that even before it happened and there were debates about whether there were weapons of mass destruction, I just said we have to get Saddam Hussein out of there, and we did that. As far as I'm concerned, that is just an extraordinary thing to have done.
So how do the scales balance out in your mind then, Tom? Does that mean that the war is an important enough issue that though you're a lifelong Democrat, you might consider supporting Bush in November?
I think I'd probably support John Kerry, because I think John Kerry would have the wisdom and the perspective to continue what is going on. I don't know if he would have gone into it the way George Bush did. In fact, I think he probably would not have.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like the rhetoric I hear from a lot of the Democratic candidates who really, you know, I want to ask them, well, do you think it would be better if Saddam Hussein were still in power? And I just can't imagine anyone thinking that it would be.
Nolan Finley, are we going to hear a lot about Saddam Hussein in the next 10 months?
Oh, absolutely. I think Bush considers it one of the crowning achievements of his presidency. And the point Tom made, I think, is insightful. George Bush is probably not going to steal a whole lot of votes from the core of the Democratic Party, people like Tom who've always supported Democrats. But he's also his performance in Iraq and his execution of the war on terrorism probably is not going to cost him a whole lot of Republican votes or those Republican-leaning independents. And I think there was a lingering sense in this country of unfinished business, and that job was considered complete with when Saddam Hussein was captured. And I think it is something George Bush will beat his chest about and has a right to do so.
You know, one of the fascinating points that Tom made was that the reference to weapons of mass destruction. It was certainly one of the millstones that President Bush dragged into this speech simply because of what had been said before. I think it might be useful to hear a little bit of what the State of the Union speech sounded like a year ago, contrasting that with what we heard last night. Let's listen first to President Bush speaking January 29th, 2003.
Before September the 11th, many in the world believed that Saddam Hussein could be contained. But chemical agents, lethal viruses, and shadowy terrorist networks are not easily contained. Imagine those 19 hijackers with other weapons and other plans, this time armed by Saddam Hussein. Take one vial, one canister, one crate. Slipped into this country to bring a day of horror like none we have ever known. We will do everything in our power to make sure that that day never comes.
And then, of course, after all the investigations after the war, none of those weapons of mass destruction were physically discovered in Iraq, and this is how the president squared that circle this year.
Some in this chamber and in our country did not support the liberation of Iraq. Objections to war often come from principled motives. But let us be candid about the consequences of leaving Saddam Hussein in power. We're seeking all the facts. Already, the Kaye report identified dozens of weapons of mass destruction-related program activities and significant amounts of equipment that Iraq concealed from the United Nations. Had we failed to act, the dictator's weapons of mass destruction programs would continue to this day.
Well, Alan Murray, everybody said weapons of mass destruction would not be included in the speech, and it was. How do you make sense of the way that the White House is working this part of the issue?
Well, I think this is one of those things that really gnaws on George Bush himself. Look, he believes that this shouldn't be a big issue. We know Saddam Hussein, he would tell you, we know Saddam Hussein used weapons of mass destruction against his own people. He dropped chemical weapons on the Kurds. So why are we making a big deal about this? I think the fact that there's so much talk about it in the press and among the public gets on his nerves. And so what he's basically saying is, okay, we didn't find stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, but David Kay found dozens of weapons of mass destruction-related activities. Saddam's a bad guy. Get off my case.
And is that going to play? Is that going to work? Is that going to put an end to it?
So far, it is playing. Look, again, you look at that Washington Post poll, and a solid majority of the American people support what was done in Iraq. You know, there are questions to be asked. You go back and listen to the case that Colin Powell made to the United Nations, all built on this evidence of weapons of mass destruction that were currently in production. That case looks pretty weak today. That case doesn't look very good. But that hasn't undercut the support that the American people are giving this president for what he did in Iraq. Barring some change in what's happening in Iraq in the next year, which certainly could happen, I don't see that changing between now and November.
So, Nolan, what do you think? Are we done with this now? Do you think the president put it to bed last night?
Well, no, we're not done with it. It'll be an issue in the campaign. What's surprising to me is that the American people don't feel more resentment about being misled in the beginning. They seem to be focused very much where the president wants them to be focused, and that's on the ultimate outcome of this operation, and that is the toppling of an evil regime. And I've got to believe that whoever the Democratic candidate is will keep beating that drum and keep making the case for the fact that the reasons we went into this war, the reasons we were given for going into this war, didn't play out.
And is that because the president's right, or is that because the president's got a brilliant public relations team working for him? What's your view?
Well, I think it's because American people are outcome oriented. They see the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the change of regime in Iraq as a very positive thing, and they're more concerned about the good that will come out of that, or will hopefully come out of that, than they are about a year ago or 2 years ago in the case that was made.
1-800-423-8255 to Virginia Beach now, Virginia. And John, you're with us. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you very much for taking the call. I guess my big concern, what I didn't hear in the State of the Union was, first off, I guess my personal feeling is that George Bush is trying to rectify, his father's, lack of success against Saddam Hussein. And that in itself leads into my big concern is this absolutely spiraling out of control deficit. I mean, what happens if, I guess I'm asking you guys the questions, your thoughts on it. What happens when, he bankrupts the government with this war on terror? I have to agree with Wesley Clark. I don't know that we necessarily had to go in like that. Perhaps he had to be removed. I think there may have been other more effective, less costly methods, and one with more consensus from the rest of the world. I mean, but more than anything, it's the deficit. I didn't hear anything addressed there. I mean, we're looking at $500 billion. I mean, my goodness, what happens to the country if it goes on at this breakneck pace? Whoever comes in next may be forced to raise taxes by virtue of there's no money left in the government.
Okay, John, I'm really glad you raised the question of money. Let's hear briefly what the president did have to say about the deficit last night.
In 2 weeks, I will send you a budget that funds the war, protects the homeland, and meets important domestic needs while limiting the growth in discretionary spending to less than 4%. This will require that Congress focus on priorities, cut wasteful spending, and be wise with the people's money. By doing so, we can cut the deficit in half over the next 5 years.
Well, Alan, in your columns in the Wall Street Journal, you're focusing our attention on the importance of the deficit, and the president's just said he's going to cut it in half in the next 5 years. Problem solved?
No, I think this is the president paying lip service to the deficit. Look, first of all, you have to say that the deficit is not an economic problem right now, but it is going to become an economic problem. We've been here before. We know when the economy is growing faster and the government is borrowing this much money and foreigners start to lose their willingness to lend us the money we need to keep our economy going, it becomes a problem. That is going to happen at some point down the road. What the president has done consistently is push for his tax cuts, insist on making them permanent, never waver from that in spite of deficit projections, talk about spending reduction, but not fight for spending reduction. There were a lot of programs last night that President Bush said he wanted to increase spending on, including little programs like the National Endowment for Democracy. He did not mention a single specific program, nor has he ever, that he would eliminate, for instance. You know, where do these unspecified spending cuts come from? Now, let me say, Dick, I think what you did hear last night, or really what you didn't hear last night, is significant, that for the first time, the president is starting to feel the heat on this issue, partly because it's coming from the conservatives in his own party. He did not mention the space program, the moon to Mars shot, something that he had proposed just a week earlier. I think part of the reason he didn't mention it is because everybody knows that cost hundreds of billions, if not more than $1 trillion, to achieve. He did not mention his new savings initiative, new accounts that would let people save more money tax-free that don't cost anything in the first few years.
That's the Social
but in
Security
the out years,
savings you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about a proposal that the Treasury Department has developed to allow people to expand IRAs, 401ks,
right. Okay. Yeah,
to save more of their income. It doesn't cost any money in the front because you can't deduct it from your taxes, but it has huge costs in the out years, hundreds of billions of dollars. He didn't mention that last night. I think the president is feeling the heat on this issue and realizes that the deficit is an issue he is going to have to deal with more seriously in his second term than he has dealt with it in his first term.
Okay, Nolan, Allen's talking about economic problems, that these things are not economic problems, but saying that they're very close to becoming economic problems. And is that the moment when they become political problems for him?
Well, absolutely. And you got a sense that the president wanted to wink at Congress when he said we've got to be good stewards of the people's money, because they've been absolutely poor stewards of the people's money over the last 3 years. And if anyone would have told me 3 years ago that a conservative president and a Congress controlled by conservative Republicans would increase the size of government over 3 years by almost 25%, I'd have said, you're nuts. But that's exactly what happened. And I can't believe anybody in that room last night believed that they would hold spending or will hold spending to 4% increase. It won't happen. This president hasn't vetoed a thing. He hasn't vetoed a single spending bill or any other bill. And this is where he's left vulnerable. And this is why he's open to such criticism for his tax cuts. And if the Democrats were smart, they'd just keep pounding the deficit, because it does matter to people, particularly when much of it was unnecessary, when much of it is the result of unfettered spending in Washington.
I want to do something that we do occasionally on this program, and that is return to a story that we told at some point earlier for a check-in here. Charles Saunders has been listening along to our conversation. He's in Gastonia, North Carolina. He's president of Saunders Thread Company in Gastonia. And Charles, if I'm not mistaken, you were up to about 100 employees in the early 90s, and you're down to less than 50 now?
That's correct. We have 40 now.
And how's business? You're doing that high-tech Kevlar thread thing. Is the future looking rosy for you?
Definitely not. Not at this time, anyway. The only bright spot has been increase in our export sales. Our domestic sales are deteriorating still.
Charles, did you watch the speech last night?
Sir?
You did watch the speech last night?
Yes, I did.
Did you hear anything that you were looking for?
Not really. No, I did not. The only mention at all was the rosy picture of the economy, which we certainly have not seen. The continuing of job training, which we still are trying to figure out what they're retraining people for.
He talked about health care and biotechnology and giving more money to community colleges last night for that retraining. I mean, isn't that in part what people who are losing jobs in the manufacturing sector need or want?
Well, certainly they need retraining, but you need to retrain for something that they can get a job doing. That's the problem. We lost half a million jobs in the manufacturing sector last year, 26,000 in December alone. That was 41 consecutive months of declining manufacturing employment.
Okay, now, Charles, Nolan Finley was just saying that, that these economic issues, the trade and the deficit that the president's not speaking so directly about, are going to become a problem for him. You've been voting Republican all your life, is that right?
That's correct.
And what are you thinking about November 2004?
November 2004, I hope I will have a Democrat I can vote for.
Are you seeing or hearing anything there that gives you hope?
At this point, I'm still listening, watching, hoping that something's going to come up. We're certainly not getting it from Mr. Bush. What he has done is basically lip service. Nothing has really, come through. Took his administration nearly 3 years just to come up with rules to allow us to apply for safeguards against China. Those were finally granted, but what are they doing? They're consulting.
Charles, I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to be with us again.
Thank you, sir.
Charles Saunders, president of Saunders Thread Company in Gastonia, North Carolina. Alan Murray, I can see Karl Rove scribbling notes when people like Charles are speaking. They, at least, yeah, perhaps
exactly.
He ought to be.
No, exactly. And this is the way that Karl Rove looks at the world. He sees this as an electoral map problem. I mean, in the last election, the electoral map was divided pretty much right down the middle. And so the question the Democrats have to ask themselves, are there some states where we can get an advantage in this election that we didn't have in the last election? And I think one of the places they've got to be looking are states where you have a manufacturing base that has been hurt by what's happened over the last 2.5 years. North Carolina may well be one of those. West Virginia is certainly one of those. Ohio might be one of those.
Well, Nolan, Michigan is one of those too, isn't it?
There you go.
Michigan is lost.
Sorry, go ahead, Nolan.
Yeah, Michigan has lost almost 250,000 manufacturing jobs in 3 years. And so you can imagine that there's unease up here. Now, whether or not the president could have done anything policy-wise to stem that outflow is another question. We saw what happened when he delved into trying to save steel jobs, and that blew up in his face and almost started a trade war. But there still is a bitterness here about the loss of manufacturing jobs, and I imagine the same holds true in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Illinois and other manufacturing centers of the Midwest. And job creation is an area where he is extremely vulnerable this year.
1-800-423-8255. Incidentally, there's one number you didn't hear in the speech from the throne, or a speech, State of the Union speech. There's my past catching up with me. State of the Union speech last night, and that is the over 2 million jobs which have disappeared since President Bush took office. We'd like to hear your thoughts on exactly where he says he's taking the country, because he's talking not just about the next 10 or 11 months, but about a second term for George W. Bush. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. With me this hour, Nolan Finley, the editorial page editor of the Detroit News, and Alan Murray, Washington bureau chief for CNBC and host of CNBC's nightly program, Capital Report. Let's go to Beverly, Massachusetts next. David's with us on the line there. Hi, David.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Sure.
So?
I voted for Bush last time, by absentee, when living in the UK. I felt he and the U.S. weren't taking seriously enough there, but I'm somewhat happy with how he's panned out, but also somewhat disappointed in some of the protectionism that he put on steel. I didn't feel he was, on principle, very consistent on fair trade that he was talking about, and budgeting, as you mentioned earlier. I think things like manned missions to Mars just really, we don't have
I think the manned mission to Mars is kind of off the table. I was saying earlier, the overnight polling after that announcement wasn't too favorable. It was one of the reasons why it didn't pop up in the in the speech last night. But did you hear anything, David? Are you hearing anything from Bush that gives you an indication of where he's going in a second term that's helping you make up your mind?
Yes, I like the larger idealistic vision for democracy in the Middle East. That resonated last night when he was talking. I believe that's something I'm hoping will improve in the second one.
You know what? I want to, if I can, go to Nolan Finley on that. David, thanks for your call. But Nolan, it's fascinating to listen to the president on that, in part because nobody's really sure how that story is going to end, the American sort of intervention in Iraq as a means of introducing political change to the Middle East.
Well, that makes people on both sides of the political spectrum very nervous. But I think what the president presented was a very realistic world of the world, of realistic view of the world today, that you can't sit back and allow these areas of turmoil to foment and become a threat to our national security. And, you know, we know now that our borders aren't going to protect us, and that we do have to seek out the threats to the United States and destroy them wherever they are. But that's a very delicate process. And, you know, we saw from from Iraq that, it's fraught, it's fraught with dangers.
So Alan, has he set the bar very high there?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think it goes a step beyond realism. It goes a step beyond defending the nation. It really is sort of Wilsonian idealism, that we are at a moment in history when we are the only superpower in the world, that history will judge what we do with this moment, and that what we should do with this moment is use it to try and install the values that we think are fundamental human values around the world. And that's what this creating democracy in the Middle East, creating democracy in the world is all about. It's a very idealistic notion of America's foreign policy, and it's costly as well.
We have no desire to dominate, no ambitions of empire. This great republic will lead the cause of freedom. Nolan, are these the sorts of ways of characterizing what Alan's talking about that people would necessarily want to vote for?
Well, you know, it depends on the cost. I mean, everybody, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, everybody wants everybody in the world to, you know, to live free and happy lives. But what's it cost, and who's going to pay the bill? And I think you reach a point where Americans start to measure, okay, how much is this costing me, and what aren't we doing at home so that we can do this in other places of the world? And that's the balancing point. But, you know, I agree with Alan that there is idealism here. George Bush has a very low tolerance for tyranny, and I think he would like to topple all of the world's dictators before he left office and went back to Texas.
Durham, North Carolina is next. Lisa's joining us on the line. Lisa, thanks for calling. What did you think of the speech last night?
Well, Dick, I guess I'm one of that 42% that isn't so happy with George. Actually, I'll tell you, I think it was kind of frustrating to me that while Saddam was all over this speech, where was Osama? This was what we started with. You know, 9/11 was brought up, but remember, it was Osama bin Laden who started all that. That man is off the radar. Nobody talks about it. I'm sorry, if you're the leader of the country, you have to face up to the good and the bad.
Well, he did say in a number of cases that the pursuit of terrorists continues, and listed the number who were killed or captured.
But he never said the name, and he was mainly talking about Saddam's, that 55,
right.
You know, that group. So, I mean, I think that's a big failure. I feel like... Well, for most of us, you have to finish one job before you start another. And I felt that, you know, it's great that Saddam is out of power, but Osama and the issue in Afghanistan should have been resolved before we ever went into Iraq.
Alan, hang on a second here. Yeah, hop in here. Is that Alan?
I'd like to ask a question of this caller. What are you going to think of George W. Bush if he captures Osama bin Laden before the November election? Is that going to change your mind?
No. I have to be quite honest and say I think the man's a buffoon. And frankly, I think people like Ashcroft and Cheney are a lot scarier, and he's the smiling little front man in front of it all. As far as, you know, jobs, the caller from another part of North Carolina talking about the jobs that have been lost, it's just sad in this state how many jobs have been lost. My sister's a teacher, elementary school teacher in California, and several years ago, oh, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, there was a big initiative there to cut class sizes, et cetera. Well, because of, you know, the deficits, et cetera, and President Bush's No Child Left Behind Act, she calls it No Money Left Behind. They've had to increase class sizes, lay off teachers. It's, you know, it's kind of like there's a real disconnect for me between what the man says and what I'm experiencing as reality.
Nolan, what about that image of the man as a compassionate conservative? Is he trying to reclaim any of that in your view?
Well, I think you saw a lot of that last night with the, particularly with the job training plan for prison inmates who are released. He did try to make a nod, I think, to his conservative base last night and return to that 2000 playbook of compassionate conservatism. And, you know, with initiatives or with statements like he made on the gay marriage proposal, he is trying to shore up his base. But the caller, I think the caller reflects, the Howard Dean strategy. There are a lot of people who don't feel this man is the real person running the country. It's been that way since the beginning. I think Howard Dean is going to try to win the Democratic nomination by appealing to those people. And, you know, it may indeed work, but
it's a reminder.
It work in the general.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to say it's a reminder for me of just how polarized things are. I was surprised to hear last night, Alan, that there was booing during the speech when the president was talking about making the tax cuts permanent, that the Democrats sort of did a little counter-clapping when he talked about the Patriot Act perhaps coming to an end and that shouldn't happen. That's in a way, uncharacteristic of a State of the Union speech, certainly for this president.
Well, I think it's become more characteristic over the course of the last decade. In fact, that's the reason that all the members of the Supreme Court, with the exception of Stephen Breyer, have started boycotting these things. They started during the Clinton administration. They continue it now because they have become these sort of political display of strength for one party or the other. And the Supreme Court members didn't want to be seen as making a political statement by either standing up and clapping or not standing up and clapping. They felt it was too uncomfortable, and so they just stopped coming. There is a way in which these speeches have come over the last decade to reflect what I think is the most disturbing trend in Washington, and that is the increasing polarization of the parties and all the groups that make up government here in Washington.
1-800.
And you'll very likely see that again in this election. I would be very shocked if this election were decided by more than a couple of percentage points either way.
1-800-423-8255 to Edgartown, Massachusetts now, and Dan's with us. Dan, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I listened to the president last night, and I was thoroughly disappointed that there was no mention of the over 500 young Americans killed in Iraq. All the discussion is on the $87 billion. The focus was on money. I would have thought there would have at least been a moment of silence for all the youth that have been killed. They're the ones that have ousted Saddam Hussein, not George Bush. And I'd like to hear a discussion on that. Also, the over 2,000 soldiers that have been wounded and are in rehabilitation. There's never any discussion of that. And I'd appreciate your comments.
Alan, I'm going to go first to you on that because I thought of it in anticipation of the speech last night. How will the president deal with this? And it's only Dan's call that reminds me that he never really went straight at it.
No, I think it's a good point, and it could potentially become a problem for the president if he is facing a Senator John Kerry as his opponent, who is a war hero, or a General Wesley Clark, who is a general. The president has not paid a lot of attention. He's paid some. I don't want to say he hasn't paid any, but he hasn't paid a lot of attention to the fatalities in Iraq. Some people say, well, is that an explicit political strategy? He doesn't want to call attention to it because then it gets more press, and then it reminds everybody that not everything is hunky-dory in Iraq. And the speech last night was in keeping with that general approach to fatalities in Iraq. I think some people do have a problem with that, and it could become an issue in the campaign.
What's the president to do, Nolan, in a situation like that?
Well, he missed an opportunity last night, as the caller noted. But I think he has to create an image that the execution of the war was well planned and according to plan, and that the out the ongoing handling of the conflict there is according to strategy and plan. He can't allow the image to come into the American people's mind that they were somehow they somehow botched this or didn't know what they were doing or were unprepared, mm-hmm. and as a result, American soldiers died. And I think it's a very difficult issue for him. I think he does feel very deeply for every soldier lost. And you know, they did, both parties last night paid considerable homage to the troops, but I think the fatalities is something they can't quite get their arms around.
Let's just turn the page, if we can, look ahead a couple of weeks to when the budget comes down. The president promised that in the speech last night. Nolan, in terms of keeping the conservative base, is it that piece of paper, is it that document that matters more than the rhetoric in a State of the Union speech?
Well, I don't know. I mean, where's the conservative base going to go? I think he gave the conservative base a few nods on gay marriage and this absurd marriage counseling proposal he's put forth, as well as the, from our point of view, the very appalling high school drug testing money, which hasn't been mentioned, but he's put aside $23 million for mandatory drug tests of high school students. And, you know, that's something that's sort of gone under the radar screen.
What's your concern there, that it sort of turns them back into something more prison-like than school-like? Is that your...
Well, the intrusion on civil liberties and the lessons it's teaching our high school students about their rights as Americans. And, you know, and plus the fact that I think it's $23 million wasted, it won't work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as the plan has been tested, you take every high school student who wants to participate in extracurricular activities and test him or her for drugs. Well, you know, I'm not sure those are the kids that need testing, and I'm not sure it's a good lesson to learn about liberty.
Alan Murray.
But the conservative base will lick it up.
Yeah. Mm. Alan Murray, the president's off in Toledo, Ohio this morning talking about the community college aspect of the speech. What's he got to do to take this from that sort of August chamber presentation last night to making it count for people?
Well, probably exactly what he's doing, going around the country and talking to people. I mean, one of the problems the president has right now is that he's playing a sort of multidimensional chess game, because he doesn't really know who his opponent is. And until he knows who his opponent is, he doesn't know what his real vulnerabilities are. A lot of the stuff you heard in the speech last night that focused on job training and manufacturing jobs, a lot of that was crafted with the possibility in mind that Dick Gephardt might be the candidate, you know, the guy who could win Iowa and go from there. Now Dick Gephardt is out of the race. Some of the values issues, Defensive Marriage Act, abstinence training, some of those things play better in regions of the country like the South, where John Edwards might be a strong candidate because he is from the South himself and could play well in states like North Carolina or Tennessee, where the two parties are equally split. So he's got to figure out a way, until there is a Democratic candidate, and we're probably a month or a month and a half away from that, he's got to figure out a way to protect multiple flanks.
Alan, always good to have you on the program.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Alan Murray, Washington Bureau Chief for CNBC. Nolan Finley, it's nice to hear from you again.
Thank you, Dick. Enjoyed it.
Nolan is editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Earlier in the program, we heard from the Democratic presidential candidate, Wesley Clark, and Charles Saunders, president of Saunders Thread Company in Gastonia, North Carolina. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.